Cabernet tends to be the sort of Errol Flynn of the grape variety.
To meet a global bartending legend.
People always ask, how do you get involved in sake and how does that connect to music?
Great single malt whiskey is made in the brewery.
Conventional winemakers who just condemn all natural wine as faulty.
It exploded onto the Australian brewing scene.
A really beautiful, harmonious community of artists and producers.
All these geopolitical incidents will affect whiskey down the line.
This is the Drinks Adventures podcast. I'm James Atkinson, and this is the show where I speak to some of the world's most exciting producers of beer, wine, and spirits and uncover trends and issues in the drinks industry today. Hello again, and in this episode of the Drinks Adventures podcast, we have a special international guest, the renowned spirits writer, Dave Broom. Glaswegian Dave Broom is certainly one of the world's leading commentators on spirits, and whiskey in particular. Dave was in Australia recently, and thanks to Fevertree, which is a valued sponsor of this podcast, I had the opportunity to catch up with him for an interview. Fevertree helped fund production of The Amber Light, a new documentary that follows Dave on a tour around Scotland, where he explores the history of whiskey as a cultural product. I'm not sure when it's going to become available on streaming platforms, but look out for the film, as it is fantastic. Prior to enjoying some Fevertree whiskey highballs at the premiere, Dave and I had a chat about the film, his career to date, and some of the most important recent developments, good and bad, in the world of whiskey. And that's coming up right after this.
Dave Broom, thanks so much for joining me on the Drinks Adventures podcast.
An absolute pleasure.
How did this movie project come about?
The director, Adam Park, ran a food website called The Gannet, and they wanted to diversify into drink. And so he came down and instead of just interviewing me, he actually filmed me. And we just hit it off. And by the end of the session, he'd kind of worked out that the way I was talking, the way that he was thinking, there were great similarities between it. So he said, right, okay, let's try and make a documentary. And that was it.
Maybe you can give us a brief synopsis of what it's all about.
I can tell you what it's not about. It's not your standard whiskey documentary. And there are many fantastic whiskey documentaries out there which talk a lot about process, go around a lot of distilleries, gazing into mash tuns and whiskey porn stills and casks and everything. We didn't want to do that. What I'm particularly interested in these days is drink as a cultural product and actually trying to re-establish links between the wider culture and the alcohol, rather than the alcohol kind of sitting separate from it. So I thought there was a story to be told about the long relationship between Scotch whiskey and Scottish culture. So that is what the film's about.
Are you hoping it's going to find an audience, you know, outside of the hardcore whiskey fans
it's a great question. It was untested, you know, nobody's really kind of done this before, and, you know, we could have kind of fallen between two stools, really. You know, the hardcore whiskey guys would have gone, hang on a minute, there's not enough about production in here. And the non-whiskey drinkers would go, well, it's just a film about whiskey, and I know what all films about whiskey are like. But the whiskey guys get it, and the people who aren't whiskey lovers get it as well. So I've been really, really heartened by the response. Reading the reviews, or actually talking to people who've come along to screenings. Say, a couple have come along, and, you know, he's not a whiskey drinker, and she is. And they both get it, and they both kind of get it in slightly different ways. So it seems to be working.
You've been writing about whiskey for a long while now,
yep.
Maybe longer than you'd care to say.
I suppose began writing about it in 1988, so yeah, it's been a while.
What was the state of the industry back then?
Dreadful.
Versus now?
Yeah, absolutely dreadful. You know, when I first started writing about whiskey, I suppose single malt was just beginning to bubble up, but distilleries were closed. You know, I remember kind of going to Isla on the first time, you know. Half the distilleries in Isla were shut. Yeah, I mean, the whiskey industry was in a bad way. The upturn hadn't started at that point. But there were these kind of glimmerings of interest. From a retail point of view, for us working for a drinks retail paper, single malt was perhaps the way out of the malaise that Scotch had found itself in the UK market in particular. So, yeah, tough times. But I think in the tough times, you get to meet some remarkable people who have long-term belief that things will get better. And I was lucky enough to meet a lot of these kind of legendary figures in whiskey. But yeah, it was far away, far different to what we have these days. Yeah.
Looking back, was there a moment when it was obvious that there was a real movement on behind single malt?
Yeah, I would say, you know, by the 90s, you began to see, you know, I think one of the major shifts was Diageo launching classic malts, the classic six. Up until then, single malt had really been, you know, there was Glenfiddich, there was Glenlivet, there was Macallan, there was Glengrant, Farclas, but there weren't that many brands. It wasn't really a category. And then suddenly the biggest player comes in and goes, right, okay, we're going to commit to the single malt category with half a dozen whiskies talking about flavour. And at that point, retailers and also bartenders began to realise that there was this thing called single malt. And the momentum, I think, really built from the launch of classic malts, to be perfectly honest. That kind of brought it into the wider public consciousness. You know, single malt had always been drunk. You know, single malt isn't new, but single malt was the preserve of kind of Scottish poets and members of the landed gentry. And then it just began to spread out.
What are some of the most exciting innovations that are happening in Scotch whisky currently?
I think the way in which distillers, and it's not just new distillers, but I'll kind of mention the new distillers to begin with. A lot of the new distillers who look at the market, look at the single malt market in particular, and say, well, how do we compete with the big Glens? You know, how do we compete with the big established brands? Well, we compete by being different, and we compete in terms of quality, so we've got to make a good quality spirit, but it has to be different. It has to tell a different story. It has to tell truth. So there's various ways in which this is manifesting itself. Different cereals being used. You know, so there's five distilleries making rye now in Scotland. Distillers looking at yeast, whereas nobody really looked at yeast for years and years and years. Perhaps different roasts of barley, so some brewing techniques are beginning to be applied. And just looking at the points of flex which exist within the Scotch whisky regulations, I think everybody kind of lazily believed that they couldn't do that, but actually there was nothing to say that you can't use rye. There's nothing to say that you can't use a different yeast or different roast or whatever. So, you know, distilleries like Inchderney in Fife, which are making seven different new makes, making kind of seasonal whiskies, they distilled, they're one of the ones who did dry, they're just distilled an oat whiskey, and they're going to continue on this this route. Who else? Off the top of my head, Arbeaky in Angus on the east coast of Scotland, a farm distillery, make their own gin, make their own vodka, and also making rye, also making excellent whiskey. Then looking at Razi Distillery, which is a tiny distillery off the coast of Skye, so, you know, it's fairly obscure. They're doing remarkable stuff with different wood types, also different distillates. So, yeah, there's a huge amount taking place. But also the big guys are looking at it as well. You know, the amount of research that's going on, kind of secret squirrel stuff that's going on within Diageo. Diageo are just doing extraordinary innovations in whisky, which I can't really talk about at the moment, but... You know, I think it's wrong to think, well, the big guys are just lazy and complacent. There's a lot of stuff really happening. And a lot of it has been stimulated by the fact that Scotch is no longer on its own. It no longer has a hegemony over whisky in the world. There are commercial pressures coming from pretty much every country where distillation is legal.
The rye whisky and oat whisky, I mean, are they being used in combination with barley, or are these single grain whiskies?
Single grain whiskies at the moment, yes. So, yeah, testing it. So, Bruichladdie have tried it and decided to plant some rye on Islay and just see what happened. It was really amusing, actually, because I heard from like four different distillers pretty much at the same time going, Dave, don't tell anybody, but we're making rye. And then you're the next week, somebody, don't tell anybody we're making rye. And I say, oh, shit, you know. I can't tell them that somebody else is doing it. And they all kind of made their big announcements around about the same time. And then they looked at each other going, well, you never told me that. single grain stuff. But mixed mash bills, yeah, I mean, that's the next, obviously, inevitable step. You know, let's have a look at that. And they're looking at bare barley as well. Lots of exciting stuff happening.
A lot of younger expressions coming onto the market now. Age statements are kind of, obviously, people are short on age stocks because they're trying to keep up with demand. Sure. Has that been a positive thing, do you think?
Yes and no. There was a sound commercial reason for no age statements getting introduced, which was, you know, there wasn't sufficient mature stock in there. So a kind of, if not a hole, then a dip in stock, in mature stock was there. So it made sense to start introducing no age statement whiskies. I think the mistake a lot of the larger distillers made with that is that they took their age statement whiskies off the market, and the whiskies they replaced them with were not better than the whiskies which they'd taken off. And the consumer went, well, hang on a minute, you know, the price might have gone up, and all of a sudden this whiskey is different and it's not as good as the one that I had before. So there was, I think, a justifiable consumer backlash. I don't think it was explained properly. I don't think the industry explained how no age statement whiskies can actually be really positive and actually be, from a creative point of view, actually be more exciting than age statement whiskies. You know, they occupy a different space. But at the same time, if you look at Kilhoman, for example, Kilhoman has never had an age statement on its whiskies, and nobody complains about that. Compass Box have never had an age statement on their whiskies. Nobody's ever complained about that. So if you've got an age statement and you take one off, you're going to get a kicking. If you've never had one on it, people don't care. You know, I think that's one of the lessons. And yeah, I mean, I think the industry is beginning to get to grips with that. You're seeing some distillers putting age statements back on. You know, Glenrothes, Balblair, moved from the vintage concept into back to age statements these days. So it's a bit of a kind of mixed bag, to be honest, at the moment.
There has been an effort to put a lot more whiskey down, and we're starting to see that coming online.
Yeah, it was kind of a temporary blip. I mean, where you are beginning to see the shortage, I've talked to guys in China about this, because the Chinese market's hugely exciting. The Chinese single malt market's been driven by like 20-year-old single malts. And, you know, you think what was happening in the industry 20, 25 years ago, you know, there wasn't a lot of whiskey getting made. So there's a real shortage of that kind of extra matured stock. You know, we're beginning to hit that. At the moment. So there are some areas of the market that simply aren't sustainable. But I think the industry is cautiously optimistic. I don't think people are producing hell for leather, but there is very good long-term planning being laid down. But it's whiskey. You know, I mean, you cannot predict what's going to happen. You can't predict economic downturns. You can't predict coronavirus. You know, all these different geopolitical incidents will affect whiskey down the line. You know, I don't know what I'm going to have for my tea tonight. You know, I certainly don't know what I'm going to be drinking in 12 years' time. You know, it's a pretty tough job being the forecaster for a whiskey company.
What do you make of the fortunes of Japanese whiskey over the last few years? There was obviously a fervour in the market even by the time you published your book, but since then it just seems to have gone absolutely crazy, and everything's kind of priced out of reach and there's nothing around. What do you sort of make of those developments?
It's a bit of a mess, to be perfectly honest. You have to kind of put it in context. It's not that people forget, actually people probably haven't really been told, you know, that the Japanese market went into like a 25-year decline. And, you know, when I first began going to Japan, very late 90s, early 2000s, and I think it was my third or fourth visit to Japan where I actually saw whiskey being made at Japanese distilleries. You know, they were, if not silent, then on very, very short-term working. And then all of a sudden, but they had a glut of single malt whiskey because the domestic market had collapsed. They'd never exported. And all of a sudden, the world wakes up and the world goes, wow, Japanese whiskey is excellent, it's fantastic, and begin to drink it. And then the highball revolution hits in Japan. And a young generation who had been drinking shochu suddenly go, actually, whiskey's pretty hip and trendy. We're going to start drinking it. Domestic market suddenly picks up, and all of a sudden, they're in the stock. Because they were overly cautious. They didn't kind of go, right, okay, we're going to dip our toe in the water, we're going to actually start producing whiskey again in volume. The good news is that the major players have all put in extra capacity. So they're making more whiskey. So there's a lot of whiskey getting made. Chichibu, as a smaller distiller, has just built a second distillery. So they've more than doubled production.
There's that Ichiro's?
Yeah, there's lots of new distilleries opening up as well. So
Mars has got a fairly large one coming online, I think, don't they?
Yep, that's right. Yeah, down in Kagoshima. Kanuski down, very, very far south, making absolutely superb whiskey. Relatively small distillery, but there's a lot of really interesting stuff. Shizuoka, blah, blah, blah. There's lots of exciting stuff happening in Japan. The major issue for Japan at the moment is legislation.
I was just going to ask you that.
I thought you might.
Yeah, in your book, I think you said that there was movement happening to try and address those issues. As far as I can tell, it's become way more confusing than it's ever been for the consumer. And every day I'm on a Facebook group and someone will post a picture of a lineup of Japanese whiskies and say, you know, I've seen these Japanese whiskies, which one should I buy? And then everyone's, well, not everyone, but people who are in the know are kind of lining up to tell them that, no, this is not actually Japanese whiskey. They're like, what are you talking about? It's not Japanese whiskey. And I mean, it just seems like such a failure of consumer law, really, that they haven't addressed it.
It's ridiculous. And I think everybody kind of assumed, you know, Japan being such a kind of rule-obsessed country, that the whiskey industry was tightly governed. And then you took a look at it and you realised there were no regulations. And they'd always imported bulk scotch. I mean, you know, that was fairly obvious they'd always imported bulk scotch. You know, that's why Japanese distillers bought Scottish distilleries, you know. But the bulk scotch and the bulk Canadian, for a lot of Canadian, was going into Japan, still goes into Japan, was for third-tier, sort of low-level, cheap blends in the market. But it wasn't controlled, but there still wasn't a definition of what Japanese whiskey is. That was still legally called Japanese whiskey, even though it was a blend of Scotch or Canadian and Japanese. And then what has happened subsequent to that is obviously you've got this growing demand for Japanese whiskey around the world. You've got growing demand at home and no legislation. So you have chancers importing Scotch, bottling it in Japan, slapping on a label Japanese whiskey, and they can do that. Or they can blend it with no age neutral grain spirit, slap on a label saying it's Japanese whiskey. They can take some barley shochu or rice shochu, which has been aged, and call it rice whiskey, which actually they can't sell as whiskey in Japan or the EU, but they can sell it as whiskey in America. So it's an absolute mess. And I think there's real damage being done to the credibility of Japanese whiskey as a whole as a result of it. The good news is, I was at the World Whiskey Forum about 10 days ago in Seattle, and there's a couple of Japanese distillers there, one of whom is actually on the advisory committee, which is trying to draw up the regulations to then present to the Japanese government. And significant progress is being made. And he was pretty confident that something will be in place within the next 18 months. It kind of depends on the wheels of the government, but they're pretty much close to agreeing what the definition is going to be. And it's fairly simple, you know. Japanese whiskey should be mashed, fermented, distilled, and aged in Japan. That's it, you know. But I am worried that unless they begin to be open about it, and I've noticed in a few presentations I've been at over the past year or so, that Suntory are being very vocal about it and actually talking about it before the question's being asked, saying, you know, this is actually incredibly important. We have to change it and we think it should change. But yeah, there's a major kind of PR campaign that's needed to try and turn this around, because yeah, irreparable damage is being done to reputation, which is a real shame.
Can people be confident though that if they're buying a whiskey from the big two distillers, Suntory and Nikka, that they're getting a 100% Japanese product?
I think I would say if you're buying the single malt, yeah. If you're buying
a blend.
Blends and vatted malts, then maybe not.
Yeah, okay. Interesting.
Maybe not. But I don't know what goes into all blends. But but certainly single malts, yes. And some declare it. You know, I mean, Suntory just released AO last year, which is a world blend, and they defined it as a world blend.
AO or whatever it was. Yeah.
Ichiro has done a world blend and defined it as a world blend. So he's been very completely transparent about it. Yes, there's some Scotch whiskey in here, some Irish whiskey in it. Fine, it's great. And nobody minds that.
No.
You know, that's the thing. Fine, that's okay. It's transparent, but that's okay. You know, Kirin, back in the 60s, in the 60s or 70s, they were doing a lot of blending with Canadian, and that was on the label. And a lot of these old bottlings. So, yeah, bit of a mess, which is sad, because they're Japanese whiskey is amazing. It's a shame to see it in the state it is at the moment.
That sounds like it's, you know, you're kind of more negative about the state of the market than you were when maybe I heard you talk on this a couple of years ago.
I think I am, which is sad to say because I'm actually really positive about what's going to happen, you know, in terms of the quality of the whiskey and the number of distilleries that are coming out. But this is the issue that has to be sorted. And I think this issue, because it hasn't been sorted quick enough, has just got worse and worse over the past couple of years. Just as you said, you know, you go on Facebook and there's lots of people kind of talking about it. I'm getting retailers phoning me up and saying, I've been approached by this person selling this Japanese whiskey. Do you think it's Japanese whiskey? You know, so, you know, even reputable retailers in the UK are kind of scratching their heads and going, should we take this? You know, is this real or not? That's not good. It's not a good way to build a category.
Do you think when the laws do come in that it will still take a little while for people to get confidence again?
I think so. You know, the nature of the beast these days in terms of communication is, you know, bad news travels fast. And then, you know, then conspiracy theories begin to begin to grow and, you know, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So, yeah, it'll take a while to untangle it, I think. But the sooner it happens, the better. And the sooner then, when it does happen that distillers actually come out and are actually completely open about, you know, why it happened, you know, why it was a justifiable thing to do at the time, and because the market has changed, the laws had to be applied. But it's not the traditional way for a Japanese company to behave. You know, so that's there's a cultural element in there for them to actually go, yeah, okay, perhaps something was wrong. The admission of that is not a particularly Japanese thing. You know?
Yeah. I heard you say recently that you were mildly frustrated, I think, was the quote, at the progress of Australian whiskey. I think you said that it could be, you know, further developed than it is at this point. What did you mean by that?
I think I probably said that about 2 years ago. I think things have changed in the past couple of years. I was just kind of comparing the Australian whiskies. We don't get a huge amount of Australian whiskey in the UK because it's nearly all drunk here, which is great. But the industry, for me, comparing it to European industries, which started up around about the same time, so say looking at Scandinavia or whatever, they just seem to be more clearly advanced and have a clearer idea of what they were doing and actually establishing an identity. And I thought stylistically, Australian whiskey was still occupying a very kind of narrow band. So there was a lot of small cask stuff. There was a lot of high-strength stuff. There was a lot of very expensive stuff as well. And there was no kind of volume. And it's quite hard to build a category if all you're selling is really small amounts of whiskey at high price. Eventually, consumers will go, is this really worth twice as much as a bulk scotch? You know, even if it is phenomenal whiskey, they will still go, is it as good? But now, you know, you see Archie Rose, who's put on, they're expanding, Starward are expanding, Chief Sun, which I was really impressed with down in Mornington Peninsula. They've got really decent amount of volume as well. There are a whole number of players who are beginning to expand, and you need some of these bigger names just to kind of spread the word of it and actually get it out there in Australia and then begin to get it out in the world as well. So I'm actually more positive now than I was probably a couple of years back. I think things are changing. So I'm going to chat about that with folk in Melbourne this week. And it's interesting to look at how distillers are now beginning to use larger casks, and there's kind of a, if not a split, then there's kind of two ways of thinking about it. So larger casks are beginning to be used, which makes actually more economic sense, and refill casks are beginning to be used. You know, there's nothing wrong with refill cask. So yeah, I think it's in a much healthier position now than it was, but there will probably be a shakeout at some point. But there'll be a shakeout in America. There'll probably be a shakeout, to be honest, in Scotland in a few years. So, yeah.
Has there been a massive number of distilleries opening in Scotland recently?
There will be 140 malt distilleries in Scotland by the end of this year.
And that's gone up by how much?
Well, when I started writing about it, there was 70.
Right,
well. You know, so that's doubled.
Yeah.
And most of them have come on stream within the last decade. I just got a press release yesterday. Planning permission granted for a distillery at John O'Groats. I've got a friend scoping out a distillery project on the island of Benbecula, which is really far south in the Outer Hebrides. They don't stop coming.
Yeah. With the Australian whiskies that you have tried, do you think there's any like Australian whisky style that can be identified at this stage?
I think what's interesting is, and again, this kind of comes back to that small cask thing. Those early iterations of Australian whisky, because they're using small casks and everybody was using kind of the same type of cask and the same shape of still. Yeah, there was a distinctive style, but it was wood-led, it was cask-led, rather than being distillate-led. And if you're working in the world of single malt whisky, the new make is what should be driving the personality of the whisky rather than the cask. The cask is there as a support, you know, as something to add another layer of complexity. But the new make, the distillery has to be the hero. And I think the flip was happening with Australia. So I think what's going to be interesting over the next few years is seeing how distillery character actually begins to be promoted and begins to emerge. And that will come with larger casks, and that will probably come with refill casks. The fortified wine cask, you know, that's come, you know, straight from a winery and, you know, filled with whiskey, use it again. You know, use it again. Use it twice, use it three times. Each time you use it, there's less impact from the wood, but it will take slightly longer to achieve kind of peak maturity. But also the flavours will be either subtly or significantly different because there's less extract in the wood. So if you put a new spirit into essentially a brand new cask, it's going to have a big hit of the wood. It's going to have a big hit of the wood and whatever's been in it beforehand. That's quite difficult to control, and that can dominate quite easily. But if you've got a refill cask, which is a little bit more tired, all of a sudden it's the same spirit, but there's a bit more of that distillery character coming through. So you can then use a combination of both to create layers of complexity. That's the next stage.
What are some of the other markets around the world that are exciting you in world whisky at the moment?
Scandinavia, I think, putting out some really interesting stuff. England. 25 distilleries in England making whiskey, and there's some absolute belters out there. There's 100 distilleries making whiskey in France now. And there's actually very distinctive regional styles beginning to develop in France, which is interesting, because there's cognac producers now beginning to produce whiskey, because you can only produce cognac for a small amount of the year, you know, so after the vintage up until early spring. So essentially your distillery is lying empty and, you know, unused for half the year, maybe even two-thirds of the year. So why not make whiskey?
And the French drink a lot of whiskey as well.
And the French drink a huge amount of whiskey.
Yeah.
So you've kind of got this cognac-y style beginning to develop because the stills are different. And also the cognac sensibility to it. You've got the Alsace approach to making whiskey, which is coming from an eau de vie tradition. So they're using barley more as almost like a fruit. So they're trying to get real intense barley characters coming through. So that's very interesting. Then you've got the Breton whiskies, which are more closely aligned with what's happening in Scotland. So they kind of look at it from a Celtic point of view, and quite overtly a Celtic point of view. So yeah, France is really, really interesting. And I think, yeah, in the States, there's some wonderful, wonderful whiskies getting made using like High Wire Distillery in Carolinas, in Charleston, saving effectively a very old variety of corn called Jimmy Red, which was used for cooking. They went, well, let's see if we can distill with it, and it's just insanely good. You taste it and you think, well, yeah, you've added some rye to this. You know, it's got the corn sweetness, but it's also got real spice, and it's just this grain. A lot of heritage rye varieties being used as well. Westland on the West Coast, and Copperworks also in Seattle. Leopold Brothers in Colorado, Balcones down in Texas. You're beginning to see Pacific Northwest style beginning to develop, Texan style beginning to develop, and I think an East Coast style as well. Not defined by legislation, but more by the thinking behind it. And again, that's kind of what interests me. Distillers looking at their conditions, whether that's geology or climate, soil types or cereals, or just the general drinking culture. How can that manifest itself in the whiskies which they're making? Because the local is really important these days to people. People like drinking something that's made down the road, but the thing that's made just down the road really should reflect what's happening around it. And that's going to be an interesting development to see how that evolves over the next few years.
What about Irish whiskey? There's a lot of money being invested over there at the moment.
Yeah, it's some really good stuff. Dingle's just about to release it, which is kind of the first of the new wave of distilleries. Their whiskies have been really, really impressive.
You're a fan of Irish whiskey?
I love stuff? Irish whiskey. Yeah. I love it. And there's a really good example of a different style to Scotch. You know, essentially, it's malt, but they've got single pot still. You know, but even the Irish single malts are different to Scottish single malts. You know, because of the nature of history and demand and the Irish palate, etc. You know, so again, kind of conditions are defining it. It's Ireland's really exciting. The distilleries are all still pretty young. So you know, I think you talk about the great Irish Renaissance, and it's still pretty much Jameson led, but 10 years. Yeah, I think you're going to see some really, really exciting whiskies.
What other spirits are exciting you at the moment?
I've just kind of redone my gin manual. So I took 82 gins out and put 82 new gins in. I think there's some really interesting gins out there. I was really impressed with a lot of them.
And they are genuinely gins? They're not just botanical vodkas in gins?
No, I didn't include them. I just went, it's my book. I'm going to put in decent gins.
Yeah.
You know, I think what's happening in Australia, Australian gins are really exciting, because the incredible resource of native botanicals. You know, I think the shift from gin being kind of the world's first global spirit, insofar as the Netherlands and the UK had to import all of the botanicals, essentially. These days, now you've got gin distillers going, okay, right, we might have to use some imported botanicals, but let's look around us. What's growing here? How can we get the personality? Again, it's come back to this thing of place coming through the gins, and I think the best ones are really good distillates of place. That's exciting me. Rum continues to excite and frustrate me.
I heard you speaking on another podcast saying that you've been predicting the rum renaissance for the last 20 years.
Oh, yeah. Like I no longer say it. I figure if I stop saying that, it will happen. It's interesting what's happening with rum, actually, because, the UK and to a certain extent the US is now beginning to realise that agricoles, very interesting, and the French market is beginning to understand that molasses-based rums are very interesting as well. So, yeah, there's a lot of great stuff happening in rum. Agave, amazing, some incredible agave spirits coming out.
From Mexico or from, being made elsewhere in the world
Yeah, mainly from Mexico. Big sustainability issues, obviously, with mezcal. But, just such an exciting spirit, And again, it kind of spins back to the gin book, Genever. Genever was dead in the water a few years back, and all of a sudden you've got some amazing Genever brands.
And people are enjoying them.
People are beginning to, actual consumers. because what the Genever distillers are kind of going is, stop calling us Dutch gin, because it's not gin, it's the missing link between whiskey and gin. So Geneva's closer to Scotch or bourbon than it is to dry gin. And as soon as you realise that and you begin to taste it, you kind of go, yeah, I get it. And I regularly put in aged Geneva's into blind whiskey tastings and just see what people say about them. And they're usually absolutely blown away. They're kind of going, well, it's obviously a kind of strange whiskey. And say, well, yeah, it is a kind of strange whiskey because it's Genever. So, yeah, I'm really excited by Genever at the moment. Yeah.
We've touched on the movie, obviously, and mm-hmm. the book. What are the next big projects that you're working on, if you're able to tell us about them?
Yeah. I'm working on... So did the Japanese book a couple of years back, which was kind of looking at the links between Japanese craft and whiskey making. So I'm doing something kind of similar in Scotland. So I'm about to start on that project. So the book will be out next year. Slightly different, but yeah, it's kind of looking at this idea of a sense of place, kind of telling the history of whiskey through going to various regions of Scotland, seeing what's happening now, seeing what links are being made to community, etc., and how important that's been. So that's a big one. Complete rewrite of the Whiskey Atlas, because there's so many bloody distilleries. You know,
problem is, by the time you finish writing.
Oh yeah, I know. No, I need to. I'm going to speak with Jansis soon. Says, how on earth did you use the Wine Atlas? And also talking to production companies about not another documentary, but maybe a series on spirits or whiskey or whatever. That's a very early stage, but yeah, some encouraging noises getting made. So, oh, and I've launched a new website. Hello, folks. I've completely forgot about that. New website, thewhiskeymanual.uk, which is free. So yeah, just a place that I can do tastings and musings and a few bits of writing.
Has that kind of followed the unfortunate demise of scotchwhiskey.com?
Yeah,
because,
absolutely.
You know, I used to read a lot of your articles and some great content on Facebook. The demise of that site, does that kind of, you know, speak to the difficulties, you know, in media these days? And this is probably a very personal question for me to ask you because, you know, it's my...
There's a look of panic in your eyes. Yeah, it does. Yeah, it's a real shame. You know, it was 7 years of hard work by a great team. Yeah, we were all very sorry that it just wasn't working financially. And then you look around and see what are the other options, you know. And, you know, as a writer of a number of years now, you know, what is out there? Where do I pitch this stuff? How are people getting information? How are people getting... It's not even just long-form journalism, which I really believe in, but one of the things is, where are the writers? You know, the nature of writing has changed so much because the nature of media has changed so much and people want stuff in bites, you know? A picture with a small caption. That's why podcasts become really interesting because actually people want to hear about things maybe rather than read about them. So, yeah, podcasts are perhaps a future. But, yeah, I think it was a wake-up call for me, actually. And, yeah, after a period of mourning, I decided, well, I might as well just get some my own site and put some stuff out there. I'm doing other stuff as well, you know, and I'm doing more regular stuff for Daily Beast and things. So I'm not... somebody said the other day, what are you going to do now you've retired? I went, oh, what? I'm retired? And he went, well, you know, Scotch Whisky closed. I went, yeah, that doesn't mean I'm retired. It meant I was out of a job.
Well, if I can retire by the time I'm your age, I'll be a very happy man.
But, it was a sad one, but we move on.
And so the Whisky Manual, it has your sort of opinion or think pieces
exactly.
And reviews and stuff like that
it's
too?
It's kind of a short window, to be perfectly honest. I wanted to keep the reviews going because there's so much out there. It allows me greater scope because it's not just going to be Scotch, so I can, you know, do some stuff about rum or cognac or whatever in there. I'm my own master, really. I've just got to keep the content going.
Now, this is something I often ask people, just being, you know, a general podcast that covers all categories of drinks. What else do you enjoy outside of spirits to drink? Are you still into your wine? And
I drink more wine than spirits, to be honest. You know, sake, I defer to very good friends in Japan to keep me on the right route with sake. There's some very, very interesting sakes coming out. And you're beginning to see them in the export markets. Sake is absolutely fascinating. Craft beer, I'm not a great fan of all this kind of sour stuff. I'm not a great fan of overhopping. And natural wines, don't get me started.
Well, you'll probably have to go back and listen to previous episodes of this podcast because we've gotten into that in a fair bit of depth previously.
I will, as I said, don't get me started. Cool. It is pretty much the only thing that Adam, director of the film, and I fundamentally disagree with. You know, he loves that cloudy, acidic filth, and I don't.
Well, Dave, it's been a great chat. We'll leave it there, and best of luck with the movie and everything else.
Thanks very much, man. I really enjoyed it.
The Drinks Adventures podcast is produced by me, James Atkinson, with additional production and mixing by Dave Robertson. You can find complete transcripts, links, and other information on the show at drinksadventures.com.au. You can follow me on all social media platforms at By James Atkinson. Like my Facebook page, James Atkinson Drinks Adventures, to be kept informed of podcast giveaways and other news about the show. The Drinks Adventures podcast needs your support as listeners. Please do us a favour and leave an honest review and rating for the podcast on iTunes or Stitcher. We love hearing your feedback, and it helps inform other people this is a show worth listening to. Or simply drop us a line at hello@drinksadventures.com.au.